We've all heard the phrase, that kind of thing doesn't happen in our town. But here on Midwest Murder, we will shatter that false reality. In fact, it happens more often than we know. And sometimes the details of the most horrific crimes that happen in our neighborhoods are lost in the back pages of newspapers, forgotten on our news channels, and eventually erased over time. We're here to talk about murder, diving into some of the most controversial cases in Midwest history. This show will not shy away from the morbid details of these horrific events and the often ugly truths behind them. What you will hear is a detailed timeline of events, perspectives from those closely involved, and analysis by experts. What you will feel is the darkness that surrounds each story, the innocence lost by the victims, and hopefully the justice that was ultimately delivered.
Joan Alanto.
Don Palumbo.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
To Sioux
nice
Falls.
It's nice to be back. Thank you for welcoming me.
Yeah.
Welcoming me to a town you don't live in. Thank you.
Right.
That's great.
That's just how polite we are in the Midwest,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
I don't live here. Welcome. You know, come on in.
Our town is your town. Thank
right?
you.
So yeah, we're back in action in Sioux Falls, South Dakota for the first time in a long time. I'm damn glad to be here with everyone. I love brunch and mimosas and day drinking. And thanks for sharing an afternoon with us today. And thanks to our listeners who take a little bit of time out of their busy lives to rate and review Midwest Murder on iTunes, Spotify, Facebook, and Audible. So it was recently brought to my attention. We have fans who have reviewed us on Audible. I never thought to check. So today, for the first time, instead of iTunes reviews reads, we got a couple from Audible, Don.
Cool.
Surprise.
Yeah, and I don't always see that one coming, did you? No, I don't always say this, but I really, really do love being in Sioux Falls. It's one of my favorite cities to be in. It's got such a cool vibe. And so for real, I do mean that truly. So thank you again to those who do rate and review. We truly appreciate it. Apparently you can do it on Audible, iTunes. You can't do it on Spotify yet, but maybe someday they'll change that.
I bet they'll get there eventually.
Someday. Mama Bear 4, one of my top true crime podcasts, gave us 5 stars. I pretty much quit most true crime podcasts when I did a search for Midwest podcasts and found this one. I love Don's voice and diction. Oh, thank you. You're like one of 3 people who do. Thank you. I also adore her corrections of Jonah, which are always exactly what I'm thinking at the time. Love this show. Okay, we can leave. We're good. That's all. Yeah. That's all I want to hear.
Show's over. Dawn's day has been made.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
that's
you're
cool.
Welcome that I threw that one in there.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks.
I also adore Dawn's corrections of me because what kind of asshole just wants to say things wrong and be wrong and say it wrong? You know?
You guys, there was a time, and we can say it here. We're not going to Jonah this out because we can't, but we do want to share this one time. Who remembers when he said Anastasia for anesthesia? Yeah. So this guy over here... said that again during an episode, and he's like, no, I didn't. I was like, yes, you did. And he did. And he edited it out.
You're damn right. I did.
I know. Honestly, I would have as well because I mean, you said
I don't
Anastasia
know how I managed
again.
To do that twice. I didn't mean to.
So,
jeez.
So I also enjoy correcting you. Thank you. Erica E, top podcasters in my book, gave us 5 stars. I have loved all your podcasts. I do prefer it when you do the ones that haven't been done to death, pun intended. That's my kind of joke. I hope that when I am murdered, you guys, oh gosh, I don't want to say that.
You finish it now. Come on.
She said, I hope that when I am murdered, you guys do a podcast about it. It will totally be worth it then. Oh, Erica. Oh, okay.
Don wants to hug Erica now.
Yeah. My only constructive criticism would be to make the when this happened intro a bit shorter. It gets a bit much sometimes. That's
not
one of
when
my,
I do it.
That, no, that's one of my favorite parts and I make it all about me. So I apologize and I will... Probably try to do better. Yeah. Yeah. I won't even say I'm sorry. I'll do better. I'll be better.
There you go.
Maybe.
So huge, huge thanks to everybody who takes a little bit of time to review us. I guess it happens on Audible now. So we'll look out for some of those and maybe even read some Facebook ones in the future, but you can review us iTunes, Audible, Facebook, Spotify. We appreciate it. It goes a long way to help the show out.
It really does. It does huge things for us. Thank you.
You can check out some Midwest Murder merch at www.toomanyshirts.com, TOOManyshirts.com/Midwest Midwest-Murder. This show is brought to you in part by Midwest Memoirs, and this is a really amazing and special family service, and it's really for people who love the stories of their family. You want to capture your lineage in the spoken voice of the person who lived it. If you want to be able to hear your grandma, your mom, your uncle, your grandma, their voices, their stories, the history of your family forever, then you need to contact Midwest Memoirs.
Wrong one.
Yep, wrong one. I pluralized Midwest Murder, which I hate that I did that.
Yeah, I hate that for you, actually.
Yeah, I'm really bummed out about it. We got to start over.
Do we?
No. So it's Midwest Memoirs, and Midwest Memoirs is here to ensure the stories of your family and the voices who tell those stories are never forgotten. It's kind of like hiring professionals to do a 60 minutes like chronological interview story of your family's life. And that's what we're doing on Midwest Memoirs. And it's really special. And I sleep better at night knowing that my grandma's stories will never be forgotten. So you can contact Midwest Memoirs on Facebook and Instagram.
And I can say it from the other side. I always wanted to do it with my grandma and since we started this, and she passed away. And then I was like, okay, we're going to do it for my dad as well. And he passed away. So I'm the other side where, you know, do it. And then I didn't. And it sucks. So it's one of those really, really cool things and a big regret for even me. So, and also, did you guys know we're a TV show now? It feels weird to say that. We are.
It is kind of weird to say that.
Yeah. If you check out Beck TV, you can go from any smart TV, download the app, and you will find us there. So it's BEK TV. You can also check it out. Go to our socials. It's all there.
Yeah. Too. New episodes
on Sundays.
Midwest Murder True Crime Stories, Sunday nights at 9. You don't need the Beck TV channel on cable. You can just get the app. So we're super pumped about that.
Yeah.
So now it's Midwest Murder Sunday, Midwest Murder Monday.
All right. Enough of this stuff.
Enough of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Today we're going back to the 70s, 1977 in particular. So what was happening back in 1977? Let me tell you, the cultural phenomenon Star Wars was born, sweeping the nation and selling an estimated 99.5 million tickets, equivalent to about 40% of the United States population at that time.
That's wild, actually.
Right?
Now,
that doesn't mean 40% of the United States saw the movie, because there was nerds like me who went 17 times. Needless to say, 99.5 million tickets.
In 77 you did?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah.
You didn't?
No. I would have, and I have.
Oh, okay.
Other times.
Okay.
Not that Star Wars.
Maybe I'm correcting. Maybe that.
Now you're really excited to correct me.
I am. Okay. I'm gonna pump the brakes.
Here we go.
All right. My apologies on that one.
Let's see if you correct this one. In 1977, Fleetwood Mac released what is arguably their best album, Rumors, which went on to become Grammy Album of the Year and stayed number one for 31 weeks.
If there was only one band I could listen to for the rest of my life, it would be Fleetwood Mac.
That's who you're picking?
That's who I'm picking.
And is that arguably it is their best album, right?
Absolutely it
okay,
is. There's
good.
So much history behind it.
I'm glad we can agree on that.
And everybody was fricking everybody else, and it was just, oh, it was so good. Oh, it's so good. Yeah.
Also in 77, the King, Elvis Presley, died at the age of 42.
August 16th.
Mm-hmm. A trifecta of lightning strikes led to a chaotic 25-hour power outage in New York City. 4,000 people were evacuated from the subway system. Over 1,600 stores were damaged in looting. 550 police officers were injured and approximately 4,500 arrests.
Hey, boomers, that was you guys. It was not us this time. That was 77. Just throwing that out there.
Be careful when the lights go out.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Carter was sworn in as POTUS and swiftly moved to pardon Vietnam draft dodgers. Pink Floyd, one of the greatest bands of all time, held the first ever quadraphonic concert. That was held in London. And quadraphonic means in surround sound.
Were you waiting for me to ask?
I was totally waiting. I was, but I just went ahead and Jonah explained it instead. So that's a first ever concert in surround sound. It was awesome. The most popular toys in 1977 and the gifts of the year were spider bikes, the banana seats with chopper handles.
Oh, hell yes.
The Farrah Fawcett beanbag chair, the Cher Beauty Center, skateboards, roller skates, the Batmobile, and probably my favorite on the list, the Viewmaster.
Was that the little clicky thing?
Yes, the little clicky thing. You put the picture in and it circled. Yeah. I didn't know it was actually called the Viewmaster until this.
I never would have been able to tell you what that toy was,
but I probably could have explained it to you in like 900 words.
Well, I think I just said the clicky thing. So, and you would have absolutely was like, well, it's this round, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
What is the likelihood that your neighbor or a bystander will call the cops if they heard a scream coming from your home. And I'm not talking about a yelling at the kids scream. This is more of a blood-curdling, my life is in danger, oh my God, please help me variety of scream. It's just the one scream, and then things go quiet.
Well, if it went quiet, I guess there's nothing. I mean, it's fine then, right? If it just goes quiet?
If it just goes quiet after a blood-curdling scream, I guess everything's okay. I can go back to sleep watching my TV program.
In 77, probably the chances are slim. Today, it might be a different story. We're much nosier today. Maybe not nosier, maybe more aware.
I don't know, man. There was less to be distracted by back then, so...
Yeah, sure.
I do feel there may be... situationally possibly more nosy neighborhood by neighborhood. You know, some neighborhoods more nosy than others.
It depends on if I'm in the neighborhood or not. If I'm there, you bet I'm calling.
Yeah. Personally, I don't think most people are instantly calling the cops right there. Now, a lot of us might feel compelled to investigate the situation a little. And by investigate, I mean, look out the window for signs of trouble, maybe even wander onto the patio to see if anything's out of the ordinary. But when there are no more screams and no clear signs of trouble, most of us are going back to scrolling our phone or watching the evening news, chasing our kids around the house, whatever bullshit we're up to. And I'm definitely giving it a low probability in my own neighborhood. Now, I'm sure there are a bunch of people hearing this who have the best, most wonderful neighbors that are going to instantly call the cops and come to their rescue when they hear that scream. You know, the type of person who would come right over, run a security sweep and perimeter check to ensure you're safe. I'm sure someone out there is that neighbor or has that neighbor. I know at least one of those guys myself, Stan. But for the most part, it's just not like that. There's also the bystander effect, which is the psychological phenomenon where individuals are less likely to intervene due to the ambiguity of the situation. And people are less likely to offer help to a victim when other people are present. That concept was studied heavily in the case of Catherine Kitty, how do I say that last name, Dawn?
Genovese,
thank you.
I thought I was ready, like you were teeing me up, and I was hoping you were going to say something about it, so you did. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, her situation is not awesome.
No.
The fact that we know about it, though, and it's been studied.
Catherine Genovese was a New York woman who was brutally stabbed in the streets while screaming for help. An alleged 37 witnesses heard or saw the occurrence, but did not call the police.
And that was why I remember as a child being taught to, we were supposed to yell fire, because then more people would show up to help.
Oh, that's
so
crazy.
When I can remember that. And, you know, don't yell help because of this, I presume.
People run in the other direction. Mm-hmm. Although it has been proven that the number was blown out of proportion, the point does remain. People heard Kitty being murdered and did not call the police or move to intervene. That's just a fact. And there's no legal requirement to intervene as a bystander. This isn't Seinfeld. And while many of us feel a moral obligation to stand up or speak out on behalf of a stranger in distress, it's also the kind of thing that can get you killed. Like the 2017 killing of two men on a Portland, Oregon bus who attempted to calm another man that was belligerently screaming at a group of women on the bus. Make no mistake, those men did the right thing and tragically died heroes for it. A third man was also injured. Bystander intervention is a term I think I've always been vaguely aware of as a concept, but I never actually heard the phrasing until researching the case for today's episode. In direct words, bystander intervention is recognizing a potentially harmful situation and choosing to respond in a way that could positively influence the outcome. Of course, if you hear something strange, like a scream, but you don't really see anything, there's not much opportunity to intervene. On the night of Sunday, January 23rd, 1977, Mrs. Philip Rangan, deep into her Sunday night crosswords and TV programs, heard a scream from inside or nearby the fourplex apartment where she lived. It was nearing midnight in the North Dakota capital city of Bismarck. The scream didn't have any competing noise aside from Miss Rangan's TV, It was loud enough that she got up, turned the TV down, went to the window, but peering out into the night, Mrs. Rangan saw nothing and heard nothing further. In fact, Mrs. Rangan didn't give the scream another thought as she went to bed that night.
I feel like that's accurate. I feel like that's what would happen in a lot of situations, right? You look out to see if anything is going on, but you also might not know where that scream's coming from, right? You hear this blood-curdling scream, and if you've heard that kind of scream before, you know, like it's different. It hits different.
But if
nothing's going on, or you're not seeing anything, I guess,
right?
Then yeah,
it's difficult. I don't know that I fault her, because would the police have responded? You heard a scream from where? What are the cops going to say? From where? Do we come check that? Maybe in 77 they would have, but
they might drive down the street. Even today they might drive down the street.
They might just do a little sweep. They're not going to go knock on everybody's door in the building and be like, "Hey, are you okay in there? Somebody reported a scream." You know, yeah. So I certainly don't fault Mrs. Rangan for that. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, on Monday, the following day, January 24th, over at the office of the North Dakota State Public Service Commission, Miss Deborah Gustin, the 24-year-old secretary of Chief Legal Counsel Ray Walton, didn't show up for work that day. Missing work, totally uncharacteristic for Debbie, but to no call, no show was actually somewhat alarming due to recent incidents at her apartment at 513 North 18th Street. Less than 2 months earlier, right after Thanksgiving, Debbie Gustin's apartment was burglarized. The thief got away with a little money and a few knickknacks, nothing of major value. What truly got stolen that night was Debbie's feeling of safety in her own apartment. After that incident, Debbie was anxious. Things felt spooky for her. Every noise ignited concern in her mind, but she always played it down and wrote it off as her imagination. Police advised Debbie to put bars on her windows and to change the locks. At least one of those precautions, window bars, were installed following the burglary. Why the bars were installed but the locks weren't changed, totally beyond me. The apartment manager later witnessed a man in an orange coat go from the building twice on Thanksgiving Day when she knew no one was home. But the manager's description didn't lead police any closer to the burglar. That man returned again on January 3rd when Debbie was not home. Still, the locks didn't get changed. Another night, Debbie reported seeing a man outside her apartment and phoned police. I'm not sure where from, a neighbor or maybe her boyfriend's house, but she called the police because she saw what she thought was a weirdo outside the apartment. And the police showed up and escorted her home and did a perimeter check of the apartment and found nobody. So, given the ominous happenings of the previous few months, you can understand why it was at least somewhat alarming to everyone at the office when Deborah Gustin was a no-call, no-show at work.
We do say that a lot, that it's, you know, completely uncharacteristic of this person. Well, I mean, yeah, most people who unfortunately end up in this situation, but if somebody just, you know, doesn't call in because they don't want to, right? But they don't get murdered. We obviously don't say that, you know? So it's we use that. It's like the, you know, this person lit up the room, right? It's like that stereotypical thing. And it's
absolutely,
like, you know, they uncharacteristically didn't show up for work. Well, yeah, sad. Yeah.
So that sets off a sequence of phone calls to Debbie's house, her parents, her boyfriend, the property manager, and eventually the police. I'm not exactly sure what order it went in, but the end result saw Mrs. Ray Keim, the property manager, unlock Debbie's apartment. In her pedestrian assessment, nothing appeared out of order. Edward and Lucille Gustin reported their daughter missing early that afternoon, and given the recent history of odd happenings at Debbie's apartment, police took this very seriously. Debbie's car, a 1975 silver Camaro with a black vinyl top, was also missing. The last person to see Debbie was her boyfriend, who said she left his house at about 11 p.m. Mrs. Rangan claimed she heard the scream at around 11:30. When police investigated the apartment, they found no signs of struggle other than a bedspread laying on the bedroom floor. Initially, they didn't think anything from inside the apartment was missing, but later learned all of Deborah Gustin's undergarments were gone. All her bras, all her panties, gone. Now, I'm guessing when her mom, Lucille, finally got into the house and was able to look around, right, probably noticed that right away. I suppose, given the lack of focus or perhaps understanding of sexual predators during this era, that wasn't something that police were checking for.
Right.
The term sexual predator wasn't really being applied until the 90s, when state and federal legislatures finally started taking sexual violence more seriously.
Kind of seriously.
Started.
They were like on the basement level of taking
right.
it seriously.
That's why it started.
Yeah.
I also found it interesting that from a legal policy standpoint, at least in the 90s, sexual predator is an offender who targets strangers, has multiple victims, or commits a violent sexual assault. At that time, offenders whose victims were their own children or their own intimate partners or relatives, no matter how violent or damaging the offense, they were not referred to as predators.
I feel like that's changed a little bit. I think we intertwine
those. I hope
so. I think we intertwine those words a little bit more. I think in modern times, my opinion personally, of course, is like a sex offender is somebody who has been sentenced and they're registered as a sex offender, right?
Is every sex offender a sexual predator? Doing some mental gymnastics.
I'm sure they've done some, loosely, maybe. It's, predatory behavior,
you know,
right?
But
I think a sex offender now is more widely used as somebody who has to register, right? Who's, they're on the sex offender registry. They're on, you know, so I'm wondering, like, around that sex offender registry time, did that change a little bit, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I think to some level it did.
Sure.
I'm no expert, but yeah, it just shocked me the differences and how long it took for us to catch up and to really realize these things and being applying them. Some quality police work did turn up several other pieces of potential evidence from a garbage can outside the building. A piece of a laundry box, a plastic container cut in an L shape, and a bent credit card. It became the operating theory these items were used in an attempt to force open Debbie's door. Police canvassed the neighborhood and found no additional witnesses. The boyfriend was cleared right away. Nobody really thought twice about him being a suspect. So all investigators had to go on was the missing or stolen Corvette and a bent credit card they found in the trash. Investigators put an APB out on the Corvette right away and spread the word to all area service stations. Apparently, Debbie's Corvette was on E, so whoever took the car definitely had to stop for gas. Is that what's going to happen to your car if it ever gets...
Absolutely. If I ever go missing and they take my car,
raise your hand if that's you out there.
Thank you.
I see a couple.
Thank you for being my people. I appreciate that.
Thank you for
that.
Being honest.
And you know what? It's self-preservation. That's why. I'm not putting gas in my car. Nope.
On Tuesday, January 25th, reports of Debbie's disappearance hit the paper and local news. Debbie was last seen wearing a reddish-brown coat with blue jeans and a green sweater. 24-year-old Deborah Gustin stood 5 feet 6 inches tall, weighed approximately 116 pounds, with long, light brown hair and hazel eyes. By Wednesday, police linked the bent credit card to a purse that was stolen 1 week earlier from an office at Bismarck Junior College. Then, that purse was found in a ditch by a farmer on Highway 22 near New England. That's toward the southwest border of North Dakota.
Yeah, that's a bit of it's not a big jaunt, but it's like, what, an hour and a half probably?
Yeah, hour and a half, 2 hours roughly. Yeah, back then, you know, when speed limits were like 45 miles an hour or whatever. So that prompted a massive
search. It wasn't 1912. Like, my gosh, it was
77.
Yeah, it was probably 60.
Were we 55?
55 or 60, yeah.
Things were slower back then.
Well, you know, Sammy Hagar, I Can't Drive 55. I mean, that didn't come out in, you know...
Wasn't that the 80s?
2000, yeah.
So that prompted a massive search of the region that turned up nothing else. Given the combination of strange incidents at Debbie's apartment, along with the discovery of the purse so far from the incident, police were certain she had been abducted and likely brought out of state. That got the FBI involved, and the push to find Debbie's 1975 Corvette became a central focus and a nationwide effort. It quickly paid off on Thursday, January 27th, when sharp-eyed FBI agents in Flagstaff, Arizona, identified Debbie's car outside the Park Plaza Motel.
Oh, man. They definitely got gas. My car wouldn't have even made it to New England, let alone Mandan, so at that point.
Investigators linked the vehicle to a room and apprehended the man inside without issue. A 22-year-old parolee from South Dakota named Mark Allen Wells.
Guys, South Dakota. I'm kidding. And this part isn't funny. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have made a joke.
No, I got to tell you guys, this guy looked like a Manson family recruit. His eyes, always half closed, gave him a perma-stoned look. Long hair split down the middle, draped his shoulders. He wore bell-bottom blue jeans and a blouse-like long-sleeve shirt with a deep-cut chest. And everything about this guy was long. His arms, his face, his fingers, long.
Well, I mean, he's, you know, quote-unquote a hippie at that point. I mean, it's 77. Everybody dressed like that.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Right? I mean, not that I was there, so I don't
know. Oh, you were there, huh?
I wasn't there either.
You must have been with me when I went to Star Wars 17 times to see all these people.
Okay, that was actually funny. Good job. That was good.
So police arrested Wells for the stolen vehicle as well as for violating his parole. Unfortunately, there was no sign of 24-year-old Deborah Gustin. FBI agents, along with Bismarck's lead detective, Dave Froelich, flew out to Arizona immediately. Before their arrival, U.S. Marshals questioned Wells about Debbie's disappearance, and he denied having any knowledge as to her whereabouts. But the investigative team from North Dakota wasn't buying it, and they pressed Wells hard for the truth. William Willis, the FBI agent in charge of the federal side of the investigation, interviewed Mark Wells twice in Flagstaff. And it should be noted, Wells waived his rights before any formal interview. Not once did he ask for an attorney. When Willis and Froelich did the initial interview together, Wells was nervous. And he claimed he didn't steal the car at all. He was actually driving it to San Diego for Debbie Gustin. Now, they knew he was lying. This was bullshit. But Wells didn't back down. So Willis and Froelich stepped back and let him stew for a while, watching their suspect through the one-way mirror. Then, Agent Willis went in for another round, alone this time. Wells waived his rights a second time, and this time his story changed. Wells told Willis he was breaking into the apartment when Debbie Gustin came home, discovered him, and screamed. Wells then refused to say what happened next. So Agent Willis asked, quote, "When you entered the apartment, was Deborah Gustin conscious or unconscious?" Wells replied that she was unconscious. It all happened in the hallway outside of her basement fourplex apartment. Wells carried Debbie inside, waited for a while, no doubt worried that someone heard her scream, unsure of how long he waited or of what exactly occurred within the apartment. Wells said, quote, "I concluded that I had to leave."
Well, you should have never been in there in the first place there, bud. Really? That was his answer. It's just, "I concluded that I had to leave."
Yeah. And okay. Again, refused to talk about any of the events that occurred within the apartment.
Right.
So he wrapped the body of Deborah Gustin in a blanket, carried her outside, put a plastic bag over her head, according to him, shoved her in the trunk of the Corvette, and took off to the home of his parents in Leeds, South Dakota, 5 hours to the southwest. After a brief stop in Leeds, Wells continued to Terry Peak. That's a mountain and ski area just a few minutes from Leeds. He pulled the boards covering an abandoned mine shaft, placed Deborah Gustin inside, and replaced the boards. Then he just started traveling southwest with no clear plan. When news went public that authorities had made an arrest, there was a fervor of hope that Deborah Gustin would be found. Edward and Lucille remained in contact with Detective Froelich throughout the entire process, but law enforcement didn't reveal anything Wells had told them until they could confirm his claims. Local sheriffs, along with agents from the FBI office in Rapid City, South Dakota, were dispatched immediately. That was on Saturday evening. It was after midnight when the shaft was finally located on the property of the Homestake Mining Company. Once the boards were removed, authorities found the body of Deborah Gustin just inside. It was after midnight on Sunday, January 30th. An autopsy declared strangulation as the cause of death. There was also evidence Deborah Gustin had been raped. And with no defensive wounds on her body, you know, right. He raped her right. While she was unconscious.
Right.
Ugh. Fucking sicko.
Or dead at that point. I mean, if he strangled her.
Oh, I hadn't considered that.
Oh, gosh.
So Mark Wells was officially charged with murder. He waived extradition and was sent on his way back to North Dakota to face trial. The Gustin family, on the other hand, were now faced with planning their only daughter's funeral. And it's a tragedy that no parent should be made to endure. Services were held that Wednesday in Bismarck. Friends and family, many still in a state of shock, remember Debbie as just a great person, helpful, active in sports, including softball and bowling. She was hardworking, and she also volunteered in the local Big Sister program.
Oh.
At his arraignment, Wells claimed to be insane, which prompted the judge to order Wells to undergo mental evaluation at the state hospital in Jamestown within the next 30 days. The state wanted to determine, of course, if Wells was indeed fit to stand trial. And when doctors at Jamestown ruled he was fit to stand trial, Wells' defense challenged the ruling, and a private evaluation was then ordered. Wells' attorney suggested he was innocent by reason of insanity. An official plea awaited the results of this second evaluation. In the meantime, in the first week of May, officials announced Wells' trial would be moved to Fargo due to pretrial publicity. But when the private psychological evaluation came back, it evidently did not go in the direction Wells' defense team had hoped, and Wells pleaded guilty on May 12th. Here's where things get surprising, even frustrating. At this time, in North Dakota, the maximum sentence for any crime, even rape and murder, was 20 years, which, kind of crazy when you think about it. Theoretically, just given lifespans, a person could do 3 to 4 murders in a lifetime and serve the max sentence each time, according to those laws. Now, there's a small caveat to this. If a prosecutor can convince the judge or jury that the accused person is a special dangerous offender or is violently mentally deranged, then they could convince him of that. Then they had a chance to convict them for life. And it was a very complicated process and essentially consisted of its own small special trial mm-hmm. to determine if that was that was the fact.
Yep.
In this case, Burley County State's Attorney John Olson set out to prove Mark Wells deserved life in prison. A lot of people were truly repulsed at the notion that life in prison wasn't a clear-cut option for punishment and sentencing. And North Dakota was actually one of the only states in the country with that law in this time.
That's what I get for calling you guys out about the guy being from South Dakota. I'm sorry. Our laws.
Oh,
sucks.
Just wait. They're going to get... South Dakota's about to get theirs. Hang on.
I know, but it feels so backwards.
It does.
It feels so backwards. It of course, if a person is accused and convicted appropriately, if it's not a wrongfully accused or anything like that, of course that should go without saying, but unfortunately it doesn't always do that. It should be the other way. It should be, you have to prove why you should only get 20 years, not life.
Yeah, that's fair. I like that.
And I'm not of that mind frame or that mindset of, fry them all. That's because that's not how that works. Right. But it, you as a prosecutor, you have to prove that they're there, it's the benefit of the doubt, right? That's what you have. So why are they flip-flopped?
Fair question. So the several pre-sentence trials were held, and John Olson, the prosecutor, dug up all kinds of ugly history on Mark Wells in his effort to show Wells did in fact deserve life in prison. As you might recall, I mentioned Mark Wells was on parole from South Dakota. What we haven't discussed yet is what he was on parole for. On paper, Wells was simply a burglar who served a handful of months, eight, of a multi-year sentence. Now, Don, I'm glad you're sitting down for what I'm about to tell you.
Well, a lot of times you can't tell if I'm sitting or standing anyway, so.
Mark Allen Wells broke into a woman's home, raped her, and then robbed her. Probably stole her underwear. For reasons I wasn't able to determine, prosecutors in that case allowed Wells to plea bargain his way down from rape to burglary. He was sentenced to less than 5 years in prison, of which he served 8 months before getting released back into the world.
So you can rape someone and then plead it down to burglary and be like, oh yeah, sorry, it was just burglary.
Yeah.
Because so what that is, what that's saying is that that person's property is more important than that person's body.
Yes. That is what that implies, as I understand it. Yes.
Please tell me that this has changed. Like, this is...
It has, unfortunately, as we know from the Jana Del North case. This is not the first person that will get free to commit a heinous act like this from South Dakota. Yeah, not Kyle picking Bell, on you guys, but rape wasn't even on his record.
We have our own.
It wasn't even on his record. That's the crazy thing. So, you know, I'm not sure what kind of message South Dakota lawmakers were trying to send at this time, but it's a stupid message. And in my mind, they owe at least one generation of South Dakota women an apology, because this guy was set free. And you know what? That wasn't the first time Wells did something like that.
But it was all hush hush. Why protect him? Why protect him? Why not protect the victims?
There were, I don't know. It is so, so infuriating. There were several prior instances where he broke into a woman's home and asked for sexual favors. But when they refused, he fled, but not before stealing some underwear. Another time, he threatened a woman with a knife and then attempted to rape her, but could not consummate the effort.
So he couldn't get it up, so luckily she was safe. That's it, basically.
Yes. Yes, unfortunately, yes. Yes.
But he was protected.
Well, yeah.
Because I'm sorry, your underwear is a little more important than you are.
But yeah, South Dakota, let's go ahead and just charge him with burglary and let him go. Even better if he's not sticking around your state.
But and that's not just South Dakota.
No,
every state around time did that, because women, of course, and then if you were a woman of color, whatever. We could go down. We could have 3 days of podcasts, you know, with that stuff. But
no, they're just the target this time.
And so the thing that we did was just like, oh gosh, as long as they're not staying in our state, then let's just get them out of here. That was everywhere.
It was,
you know, them someone else's problem, and you know, ugh.
We know for a fact that at least it was here, Minnesota and North Dakota, just based on our own cases and research.
Right.
Like, we just know that unfortunately the Midwest in particular during this era had the most lenient laws against sexual crimes.
Well, look at Nathaniel Bar-Jonah. They said the same thing. That was the East Coast where they're like,
it was.
You know,
you're damn right.
I think
it was
just
a lot of places, unfortunately.
I think it's just, you know, I'm sorry about your body autonomy, but... your property is more important, and what's more important than that is getting him out of our state. Sorry, may my co-host have another beer, please?
I was trying to do it quietly, Don. So as I, you know, and as I mentioned, based on other cases we've covered, like the Jana North killing, we know that unfortunately Wells would not be the last sexual predator who was given a slap on the wrist and then shipped off to another state. In this case, it was North Dakota.
Yeah.
After his release in 1975, Wells lived in Leeds, South Dakota for about a year before putting in for a transfer to Mandan. The request to locate was made after Wells married a woman, Sonia Newgard of Mandan, on August 8, 1976. Wells allegedly told parole officers that he was enrolled in a vocational program at the United Tribes Educational Technical Center in Bismarck, but officials there never heard of him.
But so, they still let him go then?
Yes, that's what it, like he told his parole officer in Leeds, South Dakota, hey, I'm going to go to this technical institute and I married some chick. And they're like, all right, hey, go. Sounds like you're doing good in your life now.
Oh, so they've never heard of you. Oh, okay. That's all right. Still go. It's fine. I'm sure he's going to register soon.
Like, he's going to make the time for it. Don't worry.
It'll happen. It'll happen.
So it's, thank you. It's entirely unclear to me how his marriage with Sonia operated. I could not dig up any more information on it, but Wells was then hired at the Playmore nightclub as a bartender and ID checker. Now, he was fired from that job the night prior to Debbie's murder. And again, to be clear, when he was shipped up here as a parolee, he was shipped with no information about being a sexual predator. He was just a guy who burgled some shit, but he's on his way up. Several of the women who Wells had stalked testified at the pre-sentence hearing. The autopsy of Deborah Gustin was also indicated clearly that she was raped, and Wells did subsequently admit to raping her, but then claimed that she died accidentally after he placed her in the trunk with a plastic bag over her head. Fuck did you think was going to happen? If she was even alive when he got her in there, but I don't believe she was.
But he was already able to buffalo these people into believing him on all kinds of shit, right? I mean, so he was, he obviously thought that he was a master manipulator, right?
I don't know. That feels like a stretch when you see this guy, but
she accidentally died. I mean, of course that's going to be his story. Yeah. And everybody knew it was baloney, but he thought he could get away with it. It's like, no, I definitely didn't kill her. Absolutely raped her. But clearly you guys don't give a shit about that. But she accidentally died. That's what matters more. And that's what they had shown him by their actions. Not the investigators. That's not what I mean. But the justice system up to that point.
No, they were like, well, did you rape her? Well, yeah. Okay. No big deal.
But right, that's cool.
Did you steal her underwear? Right. Yeah. Oh, you sicko. Now we're going to get you.
That's where it crossed the line.
So the forensic pathologist and the autopsy insisted that Gustin was strangled. So the forensics did not agree with his suggestion that she suffocated. But it also turns out, you know, he was, in fact, the creep who previously broke into Debbie's apartment. So the parole review of Wells that allowed him to transfer to Mandan said he had a, quote, very good record and was no great problem for South Dakota law enforcement. And there were also, get this, two incidents of Wells breaking into the homes of Bismarck women and asking them for sexual favors. Don't ask me how a guy on parole gets away with all this shit, because I just don't have an answer.
Because it was tolerated. That's the answer. It was tolerated.
So, all that information came out during the two pre-sentence hearings held in July of 1977. Prosecutors argued two main points. Wells was a dangerous, mentally abnormal person, and they contested that Wells used a weapon, some sort of cloth strangling device or strap, when he killed Gustin. But evidence for that argument was deemed inconclusive, dealing a pretty big blow to the effort in declaring him a special dangerous offender. Evidently, if you can prove someone used a weapon in the commission of rape and murder, it all but seals the deal in proving that status. So this meant only one of their points would be used in consideration for the dangerous offender designation.
Yeah, but can't hands be used as a weapon? I mean,
No, it's got to be a device of some sort, is how they viewed it. Yes, in my opinion, but in the opinion of the law, no, in this case. So a decision on Wells' classification was to be made in August, and prosecutors were especially nervous because during this time, there was a Bismarck man who shot and murdered his wife during an emotional breakdown and argument, who had his charges brought down by the jury from murder to manslaughter. So you can imagine they're sweating. Mm-hmm. On August 1st, Judge Gerald Glazer ruled against the notion that Wells used a weapon. However, he concluded without a doubt that Wells was a dangerous, mentally abnormal person, stating that his actions were, quote, completely unprovoked and showed a pattern of persistently aggressive behavior, which grew progressively more dangerous to others as time passed.
I know I'm splitting hairs here, but it's because I'm super fired up. His actions were completely unprovoked. I know he's not talking about the rape, because that's not how that works. You don't provoke somebody into raping you. That's not how that works.
Yeah,
I'm hoping he's talking about the death.
No, I think it's a good thing that he said that, because he's saying that nobody provoked him into any of his weirdo behaviors.
I realize that, but murder, you know, like,
about, yeah.
You know, murdering someone, murder. You can provoke that, yeah. You know, if you're right, it's,
what does that mean? Oh, so what is he implying? Is he implying that, well, she wasn't wearing a slutty outfit,
right? Like that. Is that what this meant in 1977? And
right.
I know I'm splitting hairs, but
right.
but so many times, like if you are a victim of any sexual assault, right, whatever, you did nothing to bring that on.
Of course.
That is not your fault.
And hopefully that's what he's saying.
I'm hoping so, yeah. But I'm just throwing that out there.
It's fair. I'm glad you did. So the classification did lead Wells to be given a life sentence. In the years that followed, Mark Allen Wells unsuccessfully appealed the ruling numerous times. However, the parole board reduced his sentence twice.
To 20 years? What did it end up being?
The first time, his sentence was reduced from life down to 98 years. And a second time, it went down to 97 years. Gotcha, guys.
Okay. You got me too. I was ready to like stand up and start writing letters.
Don was
like,
ready to flip the table
was,
up here.
I was. But I feel like that's kind of a nice F you. Like, okay, fine, we'll reduce your sentence to by 1 year. Now you'll get 97 years. Enjoy the commissary. I hear it's nice. Yeah. Like, yeah.
The family of Deborah Gustin worked adamantly against every effort to free Wells early. And so no doubt that certainly assisted in keeping him behind bars where he belonged. Several other notes of relevance that pertain to this story. In the same year, 1977, while the death of Deborah Gustin was being investigated, the North Dakota legislature voted against increasing criminal penalties. Now, that regular session happened between January and April of that year. So literally, as this woman was died and the guy could not be charged or sentenced to life in prison, they're like, yeah. Nope, we're going to keep it the way it is. 20 years, rape, murder, pillage, rob, loot, kill, yeah. Steal. This is North Dakota, 20 years is what you're getting.
If on our way home, I'm going to look up to see if anybody is still currently serving that served in 1977, and I'm going to write them a letter.
Good. Good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we got any, but we might.
You never know. I mean, a lot of them are 150 at this point, so...
Yeah. To be fair, Burleigh County State's Attorney John Olson did eventually go on to help spearhead the effort to get North Dakota sentencing laws enhanced.
Thank you.
It was backed by most of the state's attorneys in North Dakota. He said, quote, there is no legitimate reason why the legislature should limit a judge's sentencing discretion. The crime of murder in and of itself deserves a life sentence. Don, I'm curious, do you agree? Should murder be an automatic life sentence?
I'm going to stand by my original. I think you have to prove why you don't deserve that. If there is a extenuating circumstances as to why you should not get life, I think the court should entertain that.
Fair. But, that's a good answer.
But, you know, it is murder. It's not manslaughter. Or as I saw someone say on TikTok, man's laughter. It's not.
Way worse than anesthesia.
Hey, I didn't say it. Somebody else did. But if it's, I feel like I want to put the trust into, you know, into law enforcement officers and the state's attorneys that are charging those out. Right. So if they feel that it warrants manslaughter, I almost said man's laughter. I actually can never say the word again.
Be careful.
That it's manslaughter. Well, I want to put that trust into them. But if they've gone as far as saying it's murder, so that's a double A felony. Well, I think it's on the defense to say, look, this is why. You know, that's my personal feelings. I might change my mind next week, but that's right now. That's my initial reaction.
I think that's a really fair assessment. At the very least, clearly, if you murdered somebody, your own life, not in terms of death penalty, but in terms of freedom, should be on the line.
Right.
A life for a life.
Yeah.
Well, and it's weird because, you know, that's the whole thing. And if it's an eye for an eye, then everybody will be blind. And I know there's a weird thing about that, but it should be on the table.
Well, I'm not going to Old Testament here. I'm just saying, like, it's a life sentence. I think at the very beginning, you said you could murder three or four or five people in a lifetime and serve the max for each. At what point are you going to decide that this person is a threat to society? Rape alone should do
three
that.
Three murders, I'm guessing,
you know,
back
rape,
then.
Sexual assault, that should
third
do.
Third time. Yeah, three
sure.
strikes.
Three strikes.
What I'm
yeah.
guessing they were working with.
But that's a lot. That's
yeah.
a lot,
that's,
you know? So
it is.
I think that's what I base my initial reaction on.
Well, get this. Wells, in 1987, became the first prisoner in North Dakota to get married while incarcerated. Now,
cool.
The couple later divorced, and I just got to tell you, it really weirds me out that someone married a confirmed and convicted predator. I just don't get it. It gives me the willies. It gives me the fucking willies.
It's a psychological thing.
Who marries this guy? He killed a woman.
It's a psychological thing. That's what it comes down to. And I've not been there for a prison or jail union, but I've definitely been there for some requests.
They weren't asking
me, and I wasn't asking them. I just want to clarify that. Put that in there.
Don, former correctional officer.
Yeah.
Mark Wells died of natural causes in 2013. He never saw the free light of day again after being convicted for the murder of Deborah Jean Gustin.
Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
Justice was undoubtedly served, and Debbie's tragic murder ultimately helped pave the way to harsher penalties for people like Mark Wells. The tremendous weight of losing a child is not something any parent should have to carry. But in the years following Debbie's murder, the Gustins found not only a meaningful way to cope with their grief, but also something that would become a source of strength and allow them to help others who are facing the painful loss of a child. Edward and Lucille went on to become the North Dakota representatives for the organization Parents of Murdered Children, a nonprofit mutual support group founded by Bob and Charlotte Hullinger of Cincinnati, Ohio. POMC focuses on the well-being of survivors who live with the memories of loved ones, not on penalizing their assaulters. Lucille said, quote, "She was part of us. We don't want to forget." Edward Gustin added, "I can still see her coming through the front door here to have coffee on Saturday mornings." Edward said, quote, A customer of mine told me something I've never forgotten. He said I could now take one of two highways in life, the smooth, easy one or the bumpy one with twists and turns in it. I could have taken an easy way out by drinking, for instance, and nobody would find fault with that after what I had been through. They just would have said, poor Ed. Really, the group emphasizes understanding, listening, and a shared source of empathy, support, and counsel for people who have been through the same thing. Now, reading about their work, it just hit me like a ton of bricks, particularly when they discussed how lonely it can be as the parent of a murdered child. Quote, "People just walk across the streets. They don't have to encounter you. You can sense they are afraid to talk to you." It's so tough to hear.
I think it's a club that many people don't want to be a part of and shouldn't have to be a part of, especially murder.
Of course.
You know, and then just even if you just take the death of a child, whether it be from cancer or whatever, I don't care if that child's 26, 46, whatever, that is a club you just don't want to be a part of. And a close friend of mine who has had a deceased child, she said almost the exact same thing. She can recognize when people walk across, you know, cross the street so they don't have to talk to her.
I had never heard that before. I had never really considered it to that depth. And it just, it really hit me hard.
It changed me. It changed the way I deal with someone who is dealing with grief when she first said that, because it's, they're grieving their child. All they want is for you to recognize them, you know, and you don't have to talk about all of that stuff, but you do, you can just say, how are you? Or, Jimmy Kimmel asked, someone a few nights ago or a few weeks ago that had lost a child. And he said, how are you right now? I think it's very tactful. And her response was, and forgive me, I can't remember her name. I know it. Like we're going to leave here and I'm going to know it. I'll post it.
But 2 hours down the road.
Yeah. It's gonna come to you. Like, son of a gun. But she said, right now I'm okay. And it's as simple as that. It's as simple as that. So I think losing a child to murder is, I mean, I'm certainly not comparing the two, because I think you have this level, but then you have this level.
Of course.
You know, so it's a whole other club that you're belonging to that you shouldn't be a part of.
And not every parent wanted to be a part of it. And Ed and Lucille were very soft with their approach and just kind of letting you know we're here. And it's the grief and guilt feelings parents endure following the loss of a child like this takes its toll in ways that probably aren't discussed enough, from weight loss to headaches, skin problems, gastrointestinal disturbances, heart attacks, thoughts of suicide. It's hard.
Yeah, can't imagine.
By 1984, the Gustins had been in contact with 20 parents in North Dakota. One parent they met said that they sat in a snowbank after the murder happened and would have froze to death if someone had not intervened. So there's no doubt value in sharing your feelings with another parent or even a professional. Lucille put it clearly and simply, quote, you say to yourself, I'll just solve my problems myself. Well, you just can't. Sources for this one. State versus Wells, court documents, justia.com, Sexual Predators and Social Policy by Roxanne Lieb, Vernon Quincy, and Lucy Berliner, The Bismarck Tribune articles by Jane Wilson, Randy Bradbury, Jenny Michael, and Vicki Russell, The Associated Press, APA.org, SimplyPsychology.org, and The Timeline from OnThisDay.com, HistoryCentral.com, ThePeopleOfHistory.com, and METV.com. Midwest Murder is co-hosted by myself, Joan Alanto, and Don Palumbo, produced by the Good Talk Network. Find us on social medias, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you are. And Sioux Falls, thank you for being here with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you.